This is the story of the secret armies, funded by the United States, trained by Britain, and left behind in post-war Europe to fight the rise of communism. This is also the story of how they turned against their own people.
Questa era l'unica banca che dopo le 16.
This was the only bank in Milan that stayed open after 4 p.m. That day, at 4:30, I'd just signed a contract between two old farmers. A colleague called me, saying, come upstairs, I need you to give me some papers. When I arrived, I realized I had forgotten a receipt. I opened the window and tried to call these two people, but they couldn't hear me. So I closed the window and did quite an unusual thing. I leant against the glass.
At 4:37 p.m. on the 12th of December 1969, a bomb exploded at the headquarters of the National Agrarian Bank in Milan's Piazza Fontana.
Una scena apocalittica.
It was an apocalyptic scene. Dead, injured, safe deposit boxes sprung open. I started to cry, it's a bomb, it's a bomb, until someone from the police put their hand over my mouth and took me outside.
17 people were killed and 80 seriously wounded.
My little son, Ignaz, came home from his first day at school and asked me, Dad, can we go to the Oktoberfest? So I said, okay, let's go. They went on the ghost train, and my daughter, who was older than him, cried when she came out. So my son called her a scaredy cat. Later, I bought them a balloon and started to head home. But when we were close to the exit, suddenly,
the bomb that exploded at the Munich Oktoberfest on the 26th of September 1980 killed 13 people and injured over 200.
When I regained consciousness, I started to look for my children. First, I found my little boy. I asked him, are you okay? He answered, it's nothing, Dad. I just feel cold. So I turned around and went a little further to where my daughter was lying. Her whole body was torn open. She said to me, and I will never forget these words, Dad, help me, will you? Then she died. My son had two bomb fragments right through his head. So both of my children died. I just can't help wondering, why? The dinner was ready and we were waiting for my daughter and my son-in-law and their two children. Saturday was our family day. All of a sudden I heard shooting from the Delhaize supermarket. We ran out to the terrace and my wife screamed, my children. I said, calm down, I will have a look at what happened. The doors to the supermarket were wide open and a crowd was pushing out. I wanted to go in against the tide, but people were saying don't. People have been shot in there. Then they told me that my whole family had been shot.
On the 9th of November 1985, a gang of armed men opened fire inside the Delhaize supermarket in Aalst, Belgium.
eight killed and eight injured. Nobody understood. It was not classical gangsterism.
The slaying was just one of a staggering 16 similar attacks carried out between 1982 and 85 that came to be known as the Brabant Massacres. In total, 28 people died and 20 were injured. To this day, the killers have never been identified. René de Witt believes that it must be in someone's best interests, but they're never found.
If you discover the killers, you probably also discover other things.
Over a period of about 15 years, Europe was rocked by a series of terror attacks. The lives of thousands of people were turned upside down. But to this day, many aspects of the attacks remain a mystery. The bomb left in Milan's Piazza Fontana was one of the worst incidents, but 40 years on, no one has been convicted of the crime. Public prosecutor Guido Salvini has tried repeatedly to convict the men he believes were responsible for the bombing.
When we reopened the investigation in 1991, no one had been found guilty. The only guilty verdicts were for General Maletti and Captain Labruna, who tried to derail the investigation.
These two leading agents in the Italian Secret Service were sentenced to prison in 1979 for hiding and protecting key suspects.
The secret services had definitely obstructed the work of the judicial authorities by hiding evidence and burying reports. And when certain people wanted to speak, it was decided that the best thing to do was plug the source, gag them, and say, "We don't want to hear what you have to say."
Investigators in other countries also found their inquiries sabotaged. The Munich blast was caused by a sophisticated pipe bomb. Just weeks after the attack, the police concluded that a lone extremist, Gundolf Köhler, had been responsible. Köhler had died in the attack. But numerous witnesses claimed they had seen Köhler in the company of two other people just before the explosion. Despite these sightings and Köhler's membership of a far-right paramilitary group, the police found no further suspects and closed the investigation. Ignaz Platzer and his lawyer Werner Dietrich believe they could be dealing with a cover-up. They want the inquiry to be reopened.
Many of the witnesses who were interviewed by the criminal investigation department said, "We were made to feel as if we were the criminals. We were interviewed so harshly that we had the impression that the investigators had their own theory and that our evidence, which challenged this, was not welcome and was therefore painted as irrelevant or unreliable."
There was something fishy about this story. The police just stopped investigating. I want justice. I want the real killers.
For many years, the various European terror attacks were viewed as unconnected events, the work of local terrorists. But now there's evidence of a more sinister explanation. A car bomb in Italy, not long after the Piazza Fontana incident, helps shed some light on the other terror attacks in Europe. In 1972, near Pettiano, in the northeast of Italy, a blast killed three policemen. Eventually, investigators trained their sights on Vincenzo Vinciguerra and his right-wing terrorist group, Ordine Nuovo. Public prosecutor Felice Casson spent 10 years investigating the attack.
First of all, the extreme left was accused. And then, because this line of inquiry didn't hold up, the state accused small local gangsters. At a certain point, it became clear that the Carabinieri, the secret services, the police, and even the magistrate's office in Gorizia had all played a major role in trying to derail the investigation.
Investigators discovered that members of the Carabinieri and the Gorizia magistrate's office had doctored and suppressed crucial evidence in a bid to implicate left-wing extremists.
It
was the entire apparatus of state that covered up the movements of these neo-fascists who carried out this massacre.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra is now serving a life sentence for the Pettiano attack. But testifying in court in the mid-1980s, he claimed that he and his right-wing group were protected and supported by a wider, shadowy organization that was connected at the highest levels to the military secret service. At the time, Vinciguerra's claims were dismissed, but Casson, who had brought him to trial, kept on digging. In 1990, Casson gained access to the archives of the Italian Military Intelligence Service and unearthed documents revealing a top-secret organization.
What came out was the existence of a secret clandestine structure headed by the chief of the Italian secret services and codenamed Gladio, Stay Behind.
Casson found documents that connected this mysterious force to NATO. The Italian Prime Minister, Giulio Andreotti, was forced to go public, causing a major European scandal. Andreotti admitted that the secret organization Gladio existed. He also revealed that it was part of a much wider network of secret stay-behind armies coordinated by NATO throughout Western Europe during the Cold War. Britain and the US had secretly trained and recruited civilians and military men in many European countries. Their role, according to the official version given by Andreotti, was to form a resistance movement in the event of a Soviet invasion.
Stay Behind in Europe was set up by NATO. It was intended to create an organization that in the event of a Soviet invasion of Western Europe, that there would be some kind of a structure that could conduct clandestine operations and maintain contact with the Western powers.
We were in a very different time. We were still in the Cold War. There was confrontation between West and East. Europe was truly divided in two.
People were thinking about a possible confrontation between NATO and the Warsaw Pact all the time. Cold War, in that sense, is a time period which there was no peace.
This was a war. It was a Cold War. And people died in the Cold War in a variety of ways.
The Yalta Agreement of 1945 had divided the world into two blocks. The Allies and the Soviets would stop at nothing to maintain their influence in their respective spheres. In the early post-war years after Yalta, US spheres were dominated by the brutal Soviet takeover of the Eastern European countries and East Germany.
Russia's gigantic military machine stood almost intact, by far the biggest still left in the world.
The Allies' greatest concern was that the Soviets would march into the rest of Germany and even cross the Rhine. Historian Daniel Ganser is the first to have examined the stay-behind networks in Europe.
NATO planners knew that the Soviet Union had a lot of manpower on European soil, so the Soviet Union could move very quickly to the Atlantic. And if you have such a situation, you must gain access to the territory again, and that was difficult. So they said, why don't we do it before? Okay, we set up arms caches, we put guns and munition and gold and whatever you need into these arms caches, and we have people already trained who know each other. And these people then can become active in case of a Soviet invasion as a guerrilla.
In very straightforward terms, an organization, once it had been created, would nominate trusted individuals who would be recruited to participate in Stay Behind. They would then undergo training, and some of them would come to England. They would go to Fort Monckton, which is the SIS training facility just outside Gosport. And there they would be taught tradecraft, clandestine communications, exfiltration, infiltration techniques. And then once they had completed the course, they would return to their normal activities. Most likely they would be reservists.
The concept of stay behind was born out of the Second World War experience of the Special Operations Executive, a branch of the British Secret Service, MI6.
Special Operations Executive, its main role was sabotage in Europe, working with networks in France, Belgium. They were there to disrupt German lines of supply, blow up trains, etc. Shortly after war ends, these same networks are then turned around against the Russians. The Americans came in the late 1940s with lots of money. They had the resources, they had the equipment, they could outdo MI6 in all areas.
We're going to send the men who can train them to fight that kind of war.
And we have these men, experts in this kind of guerrilla warfare?
You bet we have.
After the Second World War, Britain and the US established a secret network of stay-behind armies in over 15 European countries, including neutral Switzerland and Austria. They were managed by the local secret services in close cooperation with the CIA and MI6. In each country, the network had its own name: Gladio in Italy, SDRA-8 in Belgium, Oberallagenten in Germany. Gladio foot soldiers were recruited from a variety of sources.
It's not possible to stereotype the people that are involved in Gladio because they vary from country to country. The type of people also varies, depends on the terrain, maybe gamekeepers who are working in the mountains or the forests, skiers, other places is clearly more urban-based.
And most of them were convinced that communism was a threat. So these are people on the right, sometimes on the extreme right. But we also had people, conservatives, Catholics, who just wanted to defend their country.
Men like Franco Bortolomeoli, a technician and keen parachutist from Bolzano in the far north of Italy.
In the early 60s, aged 19, I joined up for a parachuting course in the spirit of adventure. The president of the association approached me one day and said, "If our country was invaded by a foreign power, would you be prepared to do something?" And I immediately responded, "Yes." "Fine, you're accepted." I asked, "Accepted by who?" "The less you know, the better." Our function wasn't to stop the Red Army. We wouldn't have been capable of stopping anyone. But to assist the people who came to our aid to enter the occupied territory. When we trained, we were told that on a specific day at a specific hour, a plane would arrive and it would drop one or two teams of soldiers, English or Americans, special forces, who would have to take action. It was hypothesized that perhaps they would have to overrun a barracks belonging to the invaders.
All kinds of people were recruited to the paramilitary groups in a tradition established by the Allies in the years immediately after the Second World War. They took seriously the old adage that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, even enlisting prominent Nazis to the anti-Soviet cause. One of them, the SS spymaster Reinhard Gehlen, would become the founder of the first post-war German secret service, which would later oversee the country's stay-behind network. In the early years of the Cold War, no one did more than Gehlen to feed US fears of a growing Soviet menace. President Truman poured millions into a variety of covert operations and intelligence programs to counter the communist threat. America's National Security Act of 1947 provided the legal foundation for covert action and what was termed unorthodox warfare. The strategy was carefully outlined in the National Security Council Directive 10/2. It would greatly influence the way the American Secret Services operated.
NSC 10/2 says that all means must be used, including setting up secret armies, including manipulating the population with fear or propaganda, and that a lot of money must be poured into this.
The 1948 communist coup in Czechoslovakia, the Berlin blockade, and the outbreak of war in Korea did much to nurture American fears of a Soviet invasion in Europe. Suspicion spiraled on either side of the Iron Curtain.
The smoke is rising in the shadows overhead.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap. But did you know? Some companies take shortcuts. At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin. Order online at oldanysoap.com. That's oldanysoap.com. You've tried the rest. Now try the best. Oldanysoap.com.
Water-based soaps on supermarket shelves use harsh chemical acids to break down dead skin cells. And that's just not good for you. At Old New England Soap, our soaps are made without chemical ingredients, contain no alcohol or petroleum products, and use 85% organic materials and carry the USDA's organic certification. Try some today. Go to oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. Oldnesoap.com.
It's time for you to have your own custom smartphone app for your business and pay way less than you can imagine. Introducing the I Can Get To Silent Salesman mobile marketing app, a global mobile marketing and communication tool for your business. Go to appsapart.com and learn how you could earn up to $36,351 or more per month just by inviting two people or less into a $14.95 per month program. Go to appsapart.com and be sure to watch the video at the top of the site and listen to the audio message from the CEO near the bottom. This is something you won't want to miss. Go to appsapart.com now or call 646-860-9540. That's 646-860-9540. Get the I Can Get To. That's I-C-A-N-G-E-T, the number 2, Silent Salesman app at appsapart.com. That's appsapart.com.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magpul clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AirOutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AirOutfitting.com.
And behind the official face of NATO, the drive to organize and establish the secret stay-behind networks in Western Europe intensified. In the years after the Second World War, the Communist parties in Western Europe made huge gains in popularity. Their relationship with their Soviet comrades was of great concern to the United States. At that time, Peter Sickle was head of the CIA office in Berlin.
You had a very strong Italian Communist Party, French Communist Party, so there was a sense of insecurity because we also knew that the Russians availed themselves of those Communist parties for political action.
As the risk of a communist political victory increased, so the strategy of the stay-behind armies turned away from the threat of Soviet invasion towards the enemy within.
The most important document for a historian right now is dated June 1, 1959, and it's actually a document from the Italian Military Secret Service, and it says that Gladio was set up on the one hand to become active in case of a Soviet invasion, and on the other hand in case of sovvertimenti interni, which means domestic unrest. I mean, we know from the 50s on that the secret armies had the twofold task.
Some of the earliest evidence of the role of NATO secret armies in domestic political subversion comes from a German scandal in the 1950s.
In 1952, we had a member of the German stay-behind network walking into the police station in Frankfurt and saying, "I am a member of a secret army. We are being trained by an American in how to kill people, how to leave no traces, how to hide in forest. We have arms, we have explosives, and we are actually secret.
Adenauer was incensed that things like that were being done by the Americans without his knowledge. And it was not that I objected to it being done, but I would have been somewhat more careful in my choice of people.
The man who walked into the police station in 1952 was Hans Otto. A former SS officer, he had grown alarmed by the direction his stay-behind unit was taking. His testimony led to the discovery of a secret training center deep in the Hessen woods in central Germany. But what came as the biggest shock to investigators was that the paramilitary seemed to have been handed a sinister political mission.
They had lists of people whom they wanted to kill, respected members of the community. And we always wonder, assassinated in case of a Soviet invasion or assassinated in case of a domestic change of power. And at that point, everybody thought there would be a very thorough investigation of the German stay behind.
But no such investigation followed. After some deft diplomacy between the US and Germany, the 100 alleged conspirators, all right-wing extremists, were released. The case was quickly closed and forgotten until a new scandal hit the headlines 30 years later. Just one day after the Oktoberfest attack, the police discovered that the suspected bomber, Gundolf Köhler, who had died in the blast, was a member of the neo-Nazi paramilitary organization, Wehrsportgruppe Hoffmann.
Gundolf Köhler was interested in weapons and explosives. He'd also been like that within the Wehrsportgruppe Hoffmann. Immediately after the attack, the police searched his parents' house in Donaueschingen and found what they described as a bomb factory. But they only found chemicals suitable for homemade explosives. Yet it was discovered that high-grade military explosives had been used in the Munich attack. One has to ask oneself how he got hold of this kind of explosive.
In the days that followed the bombing, the police interrogated some of his comrades.
These people, during interrogation, said, "We had our weapons and the explosives from another right-wing extremist, and his name is Heinz Lemke." And the funny thing is, this was never investigated.
Guten Abend, meine Damen und Herren. Das Ausmaß der von Rechtsextremisten angelegten Waffen.
In 1981, a year after the Oktoberfest bomb, hikers stumbled upon a huge arms cache deep in the Lüneburg woods of northern Germany.
The smoke is rising in the shadows overhead.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
I'm getting older and noticing that my body just doesn't work as well as it used to. So I like to keep fit as possible by hitting the gym a few times a week. Recently, I started having a nagging bicep pain and it got so bad I couldn't even lift the weights. When I was complaining about it to a friend, he told me about Angioprim. He said chelation helps remove toxins, heavy metals, and cholesterol in veins and arteries that may cause blockages. You know, after just 1 week of taking Angioprim, the pain was gone and now I'm back in the gym full strength. Scientific research proves the active ingredient in Angioprim has superior oral chelation action that helps promote cardiovascular health. So to learn more, go to angioprim.com. That's A-N-G-I-O-P-R-I-M.com. Or talk to a trained consultant. Call Angioprim toll-free at 877-882-7221. You'll feel better with more energy. Call 877-882-7221 or go to the website angioprim.com.
In 1981, a year after the Oktoberfest bomb, hikers stumbled upon a huge arms cache deep in the Lüneburg woods of northern Germany. It belonged to forest ranger Heinz Lemke. Lemke was a right-wing activist with extensive contacts in the German neo-Nazi scene. It was later revealed that the East German Secret Service, the Stasi, had pinpointed the exact location of transmitters used by the West German stay-behind groups. One of them was traced to Lüneburg, very close to Lemke's home and the sites where the hidden weapons were found.
Weapons caches such as these were in the remit of a European strategy. That much is proven. But if you were then to investigate how much Lemke had to do with all this, to what extent he had weapons and explosives at his disposal, and to what extent these were similar or identical to the explosives used in the Oktoberfest attack, such an investigation would yield results.
After his arrest, Lemke told investigators about the existence of a further 30 arms caches. He also said he was prepared to reveal his backers. But before he could deliver his testimony, he was found dead, hanging from the ceiling of his prison cell. His death provides a chilling link to the Brabant killings in Belgium. Evidence there also points to a link with a paramilitary organization. Police Commissioner Eddie Vos has been investigating the Brabant killings for many years.
We found out that there was a specific modus operandi.
and that each person in the gang had his role. There was one guy that started shooting right away. And the way he fired and the way he positioned himself made me think of someone who has been trained in how to handle a gun.
In 1990, a Belgian parliamentary report concluded that the killers must have been members or former members of the security forces, right-wing extremists who enjoyed a high level of protection.
The Brabant killers were from a certain elite, and they were guaranteed impunity.
When a commission of inquiry tried to establish concrete links to the Belgian stay-behind army, SDRA-8, the head of the military secret service refused to disclose the names of the stay-behind soldiers. Evidence was found of a link to a neo-Nazi network called Westland New Post, or WNP. Their leader, Paul Latinus, confirmed that he had been asked to assemble a group of anti-communist paramilitaries. He refused to say who had ordered the mission, but he later claimed that he had been in the pay of US secret services.
There were many similarities between the stay-behind network and the network created by WNP. There were a number of soldiers and ex-soldiers in the WNP who believed they were working for the state or considered themselves agents of the state.
Shortly after the last of the Brabant massacres, Latinus was arrested. But before he could talk, like Lemke in Germany, he was found dead in his prison cell with a telephone cord around his neck. But why would secret right-wing armies terrorize peaceful countries like Belgium, Germany, and Italy in the heart of Western Europe? The answer lay in a shift in Cold War thinking. The end of the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 brought a kind of stability to the Cold War. A conventional Soviet invasion of Western Europe no longer seemed likely in the face of a stalemate in which East and West held each other in check with nuclear missiles. America was now determined to build up and expand its bases in Europe, and Italy was a key site. But Italian politics were unstable. The left was still gaining ground and had the potential to upset Washington's plans. Richard Gardner worked in Italy on behalf of various US administrations for over 20 years.
Italy was a key element in the southern flank of NATO, and the Communist Party of Italy opposed every practical measure to strengthen NATO. So there was concrete evidence that Italy could not be a good NATO ally if the communists took control.
The nuclear stalemate and the rise of domestic communism saw the purpose of the stay-behind armies revised.
The CIA was beginning to realize that these stay-behind operations were of no significance, except that they served as a network to keep strong anti-communist people together and to keep them motivated. It was almost like a club. A fraternal organization.
In 1965, the creme de la creme of the Italian right and the secret services met in a luxury hotel in Rome. This meeting of what was known as the Istituto Pollio would radically alter Italian society.
It wasn't just far-right extremists there, but also political scientists, researchers of revolutionary war, and officials of the chiefs of staff. So there were many who believed that you needed to take preventative action against communism with all means available.
At Instituto Pollio, the head of the army and the military secret services said very clearly what they wanted to do. They spoke of the fourth dimension of war. After the first phase of the ground war, the second phase of the navy, the third phase of the air force, the fourth phase is the phase that deals with the conquest of the hearts and minds of the population. This is the war that was fought and is still fought today. by means of low-intensity conflicts, even by means of what we define as terrorism.
Many different groups took an active role in this fourth phase of the fight against communism. Among them was the Italian stay-behind network Gladio, parts of which now became directly involved in domestic political subversion.
Of course, the individual militant or soldier from Gladio didn't know exactly who was above them in the hierarchy. But we know that the bosses of Gladio were in contact with those of the secret services, and this makes us think that perhaps there was this higher direction.
After the Pollio meeting in Rome, Italy was hit by a series of bombings. At first, they caused only material damage, but with the Piazza Fontana massacre in 1969, one of the darkest periods of Italian history began. Some historians now believe it formed part of a semi-official secret project known as the Strategy of Tension.
The strategy of tension was a complex phenomenon in which the various figures operating didn't have the same objectives. There were groups from the extreme right who really wanted to destroy the democratic system with a coup. Alongside them were military commanders, parts of the secret services, and conservative forces in general, who were using this first group. Rather than a full-blown coup, they wanted a stabilization of the institutions of power.
Destabilize the public order, to stabilize the political order, and justify a repressive intervention that would be welcomed with relief by the population. People want to live in peace. They don't want to walk into a bank or get on a train and die because of a bomb put there by some unknown killer.
In Belgium, Police Commissioner Eddie Vos has come to a similar conclusion. He suspects the Brabant attacks were designed to create widespread fear.
Here in Belgium, we had soldiers in nearly all the car parks of the big supermarkets. We had to do our shopping with two snipers on the roof. We were extremely frightened. And that fits into this strategy, which was an important element of terrorism.
Belgium was scared. Once fear has been instilled in a population, you can make them do anything.
The Brabant killings in the 1980s took place at a time of political unrest in Belgium. Tens of thousands of demonstrators had taken to the streets to protest against US plans to station new nuclear rockets on Belgian soil.
It was a very troubled period in Belgium. We had hundreds of thousands of people on the streets demonstrating against the installation of missiles, and not everyone was happy with that.
People realized that Belgium was the slack belly of NATO, and we had to prove to the American big brother that we were serious. The Brabant killings finished because their mission was accomplished. The emotional shock was enough to enable the Belgian state to shake off its lethargy and strengthen itself. That's it.
In Germany, the Oktoberfest bomb also exploded at a crucial moment. The governing Social Democrat Chancellor, Helmut Schmidt, was perceived by some as being too weak to handle the left-wing terrorism of the Red Army faction and the growing anti-nuclear movement. According to press reports, elements in the Secret Service were determined to bring hardliner Franz Josef Strauss to power. Investigators suspect that elements within stay-behind and far-right organizations used the strategy of tension to break the left and encourage a population cowed by terrorism to keep reliable centrist governments in power, but not in Britain.
But the Security Service in the United Kingdom is an independent organization and cannot participate in partisan politics. There are plenty of people who've worked in the security service on the left And I would imagine that any participation on the right has been purely in terms of penetrating political organizations. The security service had no brief, and as far as I know, never sabotaged political organizations.
The interference of foreign secret services in European politics is hard to prove, but there is some evidence from the Piazza Fontana inquiry.
Perhaps the most interesting discovery we made during the investigation was the relationship between the cells of Ordine Nuovo, the extreme right-wing group from Veneto, and the American bases situated in that region.
I visited our station in Rome in September, October 69, and the chief of station told me that he was having some problems with naval intelligence, which wanted to run some operations in Italy, some clandestine operations, and he seemed annoyed. And he said, I told him, I don't care if they run any operations, just as long as they don't interfere with any of CIA's work.
While investigating the Piazza Fontana bombing, prosecutor Guido Salvini established the involvement of Carlo Di Giglio, a terrorist with a far-right paramilitary organization Ordine Nuovo, and an informant for U.S. naval intelligence.
Carlo Di Giglio was a militant for Ordine Nuovo. He dealt with the logistics side of things. He was a weapons expert and a central figure. He regularly visited U.S. bases, such as the one in Verona. He was inserted by the U.S. into their informers' network. He kept them informed about what he was doing, and he also received instructions from them. So he was a kind of double agent. He told us all this in detail.
When you speak of Carlo Di Giglio and the work he carried out at Piazza Fontana, you need to describe him in the correct terms, not as a fascist, but as an agent of the secret services and the son of an agent of the secret services. It was the secret services that sent him to carry out this work for them inside the far right.
Di Giglio reconstructed for us all the stages that led up to the Piazza Fontana. He told us about a cottage where he prepared the bombs, and he told us bits about Piazza Fontana. But not everything, because as a technician, he observed the preparation of the explosives, but he remained behind when the car with the bombs started its journey to Milan.
Piazza Fontana.
Piazza Fontana was conceived to enable the President of the Republic and the serving government to declare a state of emergency. It was an institutional coup d'etat. In 1969, the mechanism seemed perfect.
Immediately after the Piazza Fontana bombing, a left-wing anarchist, Pietro Valpreda, was blamed.
Valpreda was arrested by us and identified.
But the public did not buy this theory and suspected a cover-up. For 3 days, the country ground to a standstill. But the Italian president did not declare the state of emergency that Vinciguerra and his comrades had hoped for. Yet this was not the end of the strategy of tension. Over the following decade, the Italian people were tormented by a series of terrorist attacks. The violence reached a climax in August 1980 with a bomb at Bologna station that killed 85 and left over 200 injured. Convicted terrorist Vinciguerra believes that ultra-right groups such as his own were manipulated by the state.
I disagree when people say that the massacres in Italy were carried out by fascists. I oppose it because all those attacks were carried out by men who were working for the state apparatus. They were all connected to that apparatus and were always protected and hidden by it.
Despite more than 20 trials, almost all those accused of involvement in the terror attacks have escaped jail. Men like Gianni Maletti, a leading agent in the Italian secret services, who was convicted of protecting Ordine Nuovo terrorists but fled to South Africa before serving his sentence, or Delfo Zorzi, who is believed to have planted the Piazza Fontana bomb and who now lives in Japan.
I was convinced for years that you can make mistakes in good faith. In the end, I've made mistakes myself belonging to this organization. But at a certain point, you have to tell the truth.
In Italy, many of the terror attacks are still unsolved.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Extendivite, a seven-herb combination of garlic, cayenne, hawthorn, bilberry, ginkgo biloba, valerian, and milk thistle. Extendivite is designed to strengthen the heart and arteries and help the body heal itself. Doctors are not able to explain the improvements they are seeing in their patients' health who are taking Extendivite. People who once needed more pills are now taking less and getting better. Due to the unexplainable improvements in their patients' health, more doctors are calling to order Extendivite for themselves. Help Extendivite make your doctor a believer. Extendivite is available in capsule or liquid form for just $69.95 for a two-month supply. To get started, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap. But did you know? Some companies take shortcuts. At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin. Order online at oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. You've tried the rest. Now try the best. Oldnesoap.com.
Water-based soaps on supermarket shelves use harsh chemical acids to break down dead skin cells. And that's just not good for you. At Old New England Soap, our soaps are made without chemical ingredients, contain no alcohol or petroleum products, and use 85% organic materials and carry the USDA's organic certification. Try some today. Go to oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. Oldnesoap.com.
For the Piazza Fontana murders, we still haven't found anyone guilty from a judicial point of view, even if the truth is in the thousands of documents collected by the Commission of Inquiry into the attacks.
In Belgium, too, many are still waiting for the answers that have eluded the Brabant investigation for so long.
An état qui accepte.
A state that accepts that you can gun down men, women and children in three attacks in 2 days simply because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time doing their shopping is a state that doesn't merit respect and that doesn't deserve to survive.
How can a population be expected to have faith in the future if 16 people are gunned down in the space of a few minutes and nobody gives a damn about the results?
So there must be, and until today, I think, people I don't know who don't want the truth to be known. I'm sure of that.
In Munich, some still hope that the real instigators of the Oktoberfest massacre might one day be brought to justice.
The best chance to find out who was really behind this bomb came immediately after the attack. The witnesses who said that Köhler was accompanied should have been interviewed far more thoroughly. Today, the crime scene evidence could be analyzed with the latest scientific methods. In recent years, we've seen a great many unsolved murders solved in this way.
Lawyer Werner Dietrich and victims Platzer and Martinez are still trying to have the inquiry into the Oktoberfest attack reopened. But they've discovered that much of the original evidence is missing.
Unfortunately, the Federal Public Prosecutor's Office has informed me that a lot of evidence they had been expecting to get hold of has been destroyed or thrown away. There are no traces left.
How could they destroy the actual exhibits for the trial? In other cases, suspects are still being pursued. Here we are dealing with mass murderers, and they destroy the evidence.
It's highly unusual in an inquiry that has neither expired nor been judicially completely closed that the bomb fragments and body parts, etc., should be destroyed. The question is, what kind of interests lie behind this, and what's being covered up?
I will continue fighting until the real killers are found.
NATO's secret army is an unfinished story. In November 1990, the European Parliament condemned Gladio and Stay Behind, requesting full investigations, which have yet to be done, and the complete dismantlement of these paramilitary structures. But 20 years on, there's no real proof that these secret armies have been disbanded.
Those people who are so enthusiastic about covert operations should remember, first of all, they don't remain secret for very long. And they should ask themselves, if this operation becomes public, what will be the reaction, not only in America, but in the country concerned? What will it do to America's moral authority?
The legacy of stay-behinds is that the tactics that created the stay-behinds in the first place are still in place and continue to be used today. They are standard operating procedure. The people who pay the primary price for this are ordinary men and women globally.
The post-war fear of communism had created a secret army with deadly consequences. As wars are conducted against the new enemies of the West, can we believe that the lessons of the stay-behind armies have been learnt?